Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Episode 3 of New Scientist 2019, April the 6th. This is Rehab Podcasting, where I get my skills up. Unfortunately, in my last podcast, I had the microphone on the outside of my jacket and didn't realise it was rustling all the way through, so apologies for that. That's actually quite an interesting, or for me, an interesting podcast about the chemical structure of Dettol, which I found an interesting one to explore in terms of the quantum wave function on it, the electron affinity, and whether it was an acetyl base, and then linking it into the what's emerging for me is a field of folk science or folk beliefs, and how folk beliefs are very much alive, that they require a culture, a folk, for them to operate in a series of social rules to operate in. This one here, I hope to continue reading, it's from comment. I'll do this one here. Guaranteed uncertainty. Mathematics of game theory reveal how UK has missed an opportunity to resolve the chaos of the Brexit, says Petros Sakaris. Now, what I want to say here is that this is very much along the same idea of let's remove the social energy from it, the folk energy from it, and start looking at the mathematics of it, which I'm slowly beginning to do. Because there's not much, you know, once you're abandoned, that's it. Once you're pushed off to the side of the track, that's it as far as they're concerned. And, of course, the maths just doesn't stop. Okay. As this magazine went to press, the status of the UK Brexit negotiation was still unclear. This has been the default description for months and is unlikely to change anytime soon. But last week, the House of Commons missed one of its best opportunities yet to break the Brexit deadlock. On the 27th of March, MPs proceeded with an array of indicative votes whereby the series of potential outcomes, including the no-deal options, were proposed by the Speaker of the House, John Becrow. And that's interesting. I didn't realise that was proposed by the Speaker of the House. He then compiled a short list of 8 for all the MPs to vote on in a strict yes or no manner, giving the UK Prime Minister Theresa May the option to decide which, if any, to officially subject to voting in the House. Yeah, you can see that this person is not thinking, obviously, mathematically. In the end, all 8 proposals were voted down, giving the Prime Minister no clear path forward, but things could have been said very differently because, as with any voting procedure, the process is little by the hope House is open to manipulation. And this is absolutely true. Such deal-making falls within the purview of game theory. You think how the other people are going to operate. That's basically game theory. Take into account how the people are going to operate. So that's correct. A branch of mathematics dedicated to analysing potential outcomes of multi-party negotiations. Well, it's not the outcomes, it's the actions, modelling, you model not the outcome, but what the multi-party thing's going to do, not the outcomes. I think that's a bad description of it. The 8 options on Wednesday's ballot paper could be reduced to 3 broad scenarios. No deal, which includes alternative deals unacceptable to the European Union, May's deal, other proposals that require further discussions, including a new referendum. I can't see how that's 3. Okay, oh yeah, so no deal, alternative deals, and May's deal. Hard Brexiteers were free to vote exclusively for the first option. Okay, the majority of MPs, meanwhile, preferring some deal or no deal, were likely to opt for one of the new options rather than May's proposal. That's because the number of options that Becrow included on the ballot, each single choice, attracted fewer positive votes. That effectively split the moderate vote and resulted in a loss of all 8 scenarios. If Parliament had generally wanted to subvert the European strategy of forcing a choice between the two evils of hard Brexit and an unpopular deal, there should have been just 3 options on the table. With the vote decided with such haste, the procedure may not have been sufficiently thought through. I think that would be obviously through. And I think this is interesting with election strategists here. They start to work out what's going to go. There should have been just 3 options for the table. If the vote decided on such haste, the procedure was not sufficiently thought through. Even the voting system, for example, didn't have a dramatic impact on the election's outcome. A preferential vote, for instance, would have brought forward a single winner and resolved some dilemmas, while subsequential voting for one option or another would have given more power to the bureau to orient the outcome when selecting the voting order. As it is, the result of the vote is still more uncertainty and further delay in negotiation of Brussels, which I'm saying that, as far as you can see, it's like anything. Once you have an understanding, you have an obligation. It's like any professional thing. Like if you're a heart surgeon, you see heart symptoms, you have an obligation to act. And so, once I understand this, I have an obligation to act, as far as I can see, politically speaking. Avoid over sharenting. Okay, parenting. Consider your child's legacy next time you post that hilarious picture, says Linda Geddes. Quote, Mum, we have discussed this. You may not post anything without my consent. These words posted on Instagram by 14-year-old Apple Mountain. I like that. Apple Mountain, in response to the image of hers shared by the mum, Gwyneth Paltrow, has her mum, Apple Mountain, Gwyneth Paltrow. Okay, I don't quite understand how that works. Or the father would be called Martin, I suppose, has reignited the debate over whether it's ever okay to put pictures out of your own children online. It's best not to, I'd say. You know, what the heck are you doing? Apple's world has become a common refrain as the current generation of children grows up. Many of them have had a digital footprint before they could even walk. About 98% of mothers and 89% of fathers report having uploaded photographs of their child to Facebook, according to the 2012 study. Well, that's years old. Concerns mainly revolve around two issues. First, safety. According to Australia's eSafety Commission, about half the images shared on pedophilia sites were taken from social media sites. The advice is simple. Don't post your photos of a child in a state of undress and avoid images on which their school uniform location is identified. Completely. When I do YouTube things, I blur out the students completely or have them facing away. I have no faces. This is an educational one. Say if I'm doing chemical reaction and a student walks past or something like that. Which could leave them vulnerable to grooming, says Child Charity NSPCC. Avoid posting personal information to minimise the risk of identity theft to ensure your privacy settings are strict. You might also consider using a pet name for your child online, making it hard to link information with them. Well, yeah. Yeah, I think so. The second issue, as Apple absolutely notes, is that of consent. What would your child want to see about themselves online in the future? It is interesting, the entire parenting, you're acting in locus parentis, you're acting as a past custodian of the child in the future. And I think there's this entire... I'm actually eaten alive by Miss Mozzies at the moment. It's about three of them all having a go. It's a bit dark here. Okay, so this is the entire thing. I don't think people really understand about the entire thing of a social thing. You're teaching a student now, but the result of teaching them now is an event in the future. So your obligation is to a future situation. So you are taking, if you teach them incorrect physics, for instance, and this causes them to cause an accident and a bridge to fall down, you are responsible. You're involved in the future. This is the entire thing of social things. That's my belief, at least. Okay, and this is why I think I've got an obligation to work out a way to get correct science over folk science, because folk science ultimately kills people directly by the folk process, and also that folk science isn't as good as real science. There's two reasons. Okay, videos of the mid-temper tantrum can be amusing now, but could be used by bullies. Given that employers often use social networking sites to research candidates, it's also worth considering how they might view such information. Even seemingly innocuous photos may become a source of conflict in the future, depending on your child's disposition or your changing relationships with them. Of course, certain photos are likely to be more problematic than others. Embarrassing birthmark at the time of a toddler smeared feces over the floor. Many parenting values support the online sharing of parental struggles that can bring, but our children may not think as for us. I think that's really author of Bumpology, the myth-busting pregnancy book for curious parents to be. I think that's actually quite a an interesting thing. You have to be very sensitive, and I think what my other aspect is that people generally have one project in mind, so they don't have multiple projects that they're operating. They've got one agenda. You know, they're doing, what are we doing today? Let's clear the deck. Let's have a clean desk. I only have one thing. And therefore, they overthink or over stress getting their one thing forward, because they've only bet on one thing forward. So they sort of get sucked into this folk knowledge. Okay. Does air pollution really cause teen psychosis? I must admit, I quite don't understand the psychosis. I think, from my understanding of psychosis, it's a belief not held through rational testing. So if you have do a psychological test and someone consistently sees something else that is not explained by the test, there's a psychotic input into it. So I've recently been folk diagnosed as being psychotically happy. That is, I'm happy in a way that irritates other people, so therefore it must be psychotically happy. So it's interesting too. This is articles by Adam Vaughan. Okay, look, I've been still been absolutely murdered by mosquitoes. We know dirty air is bad for our bodies, causing the equivalent of millions of deaths worldwide every year, making it the biggest killer, a bigger killer than smoking. But could air pollution be as bad for our minds too? Well, it is smoking, but not in a different form. It's sort of secondhand to smoking. A study has found that psychotic experiences, which can involve hearing or seeing something that others don't, are more common amongst teenagers. In the UK's most polluted areas. Well, I would say there's that, but you could say that quantum physicists is psychotic because they see molecules and equations that other people who haven't studied quantum physics see. So I would just say that. However, the association doesn't mean that breathing air pollution leads to psychosis in teenagers, because it could be better explanations. The study doesn't show causation, says Helen Fisher of King's College London, one of the authors. Fisher, which is interesting, that's thank a good, there's what it, there is a branch of mathematics called cause analysis. I think they said, do better grades cause better performance, or does better performance cause better grades? A chicken and the egg story. And I researched, and there was a Max Planck Institute who did causational analysis, so you can analyze these statistics and tease out whether one causes the other. So it's not a question, because they can't tell it doesn't mean it's not that not identifiable with the statistics. So this sort of thing is students T-advanced. I've really, unfortunately, my brain's been fried. I can't really think of the statistics. I know of the knowledge, but not of the direct knowledge. Fisher and her colleagues found that 30% of a group of 2,018-year-olds reported having at least one psychotic experience in their teens. Other researchers, adults, on young adults, reported similar figures. So, I've been identified as psychotic really doesn't really mean all that much, because it's 30%. It's not so, you know, it'd be interesting to say what they think the percentage is. When teenagers, so this is your test with it self-identified, because it's just looking. Yeah, okay. When the teenagers' addresses were mapped against air pollution, their areas with higher pollutions were more likely to have reported a psychotic experience. Well, there you go. Positions against air pollution means that you're also in an industrialised, high-stress area with more, more a whole lot of other things like road noise and I don't know. In areas with the highest levels of nitrous oxide pollutants produced by diesel cars, 16 teens reported psychotic experiences for every 20 teens who didn't. Now, I think it's catalytic converters don't work effectively at the high temperatures for diesel, because I think what it does is that one catalytic converter converts or basically the first rhodium, and it's palladium. Rhodium first produces oxygen, and the next one reburns the oxygen with the remaining carbon monoxide and other pollutants afterwards. So the first one reacts at temperature, and then so it's a two-part catalytic converter, but I don't think that works with diesel. I have to really wrap my head on that. And what so your catalytic converter runs a series of chemical reactions, which the first section creates oxygen, and the second section reburns that oxygen, so it gets more complete combustion second time at lower temperature using the catalyst, which is what you want, of course. Reported psychotic experiences for every 20 teens who didn't, with the number falling between 7 every 20 in every 20 for clean areas. So that's 7 in 20 is roughly 30%, but 12 is over 50%. Well, that's significant, isn't it? It isn't known how air pollution might be linked to psychotic experience. One speculative mechanism put forward by the team, that built up of pollutants can directly influence the brain. Well, that's speculative. Studies have linked air pollution with inflammation, degeneration in the frontal cortex and part of the brain that gives us the sense of smell. The olfactory bulb, inflammation of the brain, can be linked to psychosis. Oh, dear. A simpler explanation could be that it isn't the dirty air itself behind it, but the noise from cars emitting pollution. Noise pollution can increase the stress and disrupt sleep, two factors associated with psychotic experiences. There's no evidence that pollution necessarily causes psychosis, or whether it may cause factors acting or acting in isolation, says Sophie Dix, the mental health charity MQ. But the study provides a starting point for fossil links between pollution and psychosis, she says. There is emerging body of research looking at possible links between air pollution and mental health. For example, a link has been found between polluted areas and Swedish children being given medication for psychiatric disorders. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's, psychosis. I don't know whether psychosis is a treatable, by itself is a treatable condition or analysis. Psychosis is, I think, probably a symptom of something. Something is a symptom, so you can't diagnose someone with psychosis outright, even though I have. Analyze that. My other thing is, obviously, you therefore say, well, if I put a lot of group children into a high stress school and increase the stress, I can then start managing the psychosis to mold and shape the stress. You can get a psychotic situation. These are compelling cases for further investigation into toxic air's potential connection to mental health, says Stephen Rees of the Centre of Ecology and Hydrology in the UK. But there is limited evidence as that so far, says Fisher. It's really preliminary. We don't much. Fortunately, the world doesn't need to wait for evidence of any link between pollution and mental health to act on what we pump into the air. We know plenty of physical harm the air pollution causes. Tiny particulate matter can penetrate deep within lungs and the bloodstream, causing heart and lung problems, including infections, aggravating asthma. It's also been associated with low weights and premature births, obviously. There's a huge wedge of evidence on the physical effects, says Fisher. I should say I knew the person doing autopsies up in the mountains, and they'd find a person and they'd know whether they came from the country or the city. The city, that they have this fine little black carbon lace in their lungs. But I think this is if they're the old people who lived in the coalish thing. Okay, there's the hoopy headwear picture. Obviously not much good reading yet to you. Mind tricks. The symptoms are very real, but all the I have to apologise. I said that I read this article, but it hasn't. And it's rather beautiful. They've got a picture of the brain as a tree and a branch. And it's a very artistic interpretation of the article. Okay, so let's read it. Mind tricks. The symptoms are very real, but all the tests say there's nothing physically wrong. A group of mystery disorders show how we can think ourselves ill and well again, says Claire Wilson. So that must be the key to it, that it's not a downhill thing, that you can abandon people because they've got screw minds. Those screw minds could perhaps be used for good, because there's a lot of screw minds out there. Amanda Payne's seizures weren't going away, despite taking strong epilepsy drugs. One time she felt the warning signs just before getting off the bus on a busy road in Glasgow. She only just made it to the pavement before collapsing and convulsing. Payne was sent for further investigations. Like many people with epilepsy, she had been diagnosed based on a history of sudden blackouts, but never undergone a definitive test to record her brain electrical activities during such an episode. This time, she was admitted to the hospital, where she wore electrodes on her head for 4 days. By the end, doctors knew one thing. Whatever was wrong, it wasn't epilepsy. Despite 4 years of apparent seizures, her brain had all the appearances of working fine. As to the real problem, the doctors had no simple explanation. But they had seen this before. Yeah, this is the absolute thing. Pain is one group of people with neurological symptoms, those affecting the nervous systems that defy all the usual medical tests, as well as seizures. Other manifestations include paralysis, tremor, blindness and pain, with no physical cause can be found. Until recently, those who experienced the disorders were routinely dismissed by medical professions as attention seekers and fakers. Well, I have to say that from the inside, when the education department get told confidentially that this particular student is doing this, but there's no medical condition for it, obviously they have to tell you that, they immediately go, oh, they're faking it, oh, we know how to handle it, and sort of completely unprofessional. I've said that many times, or two or three times. In the past decade, though, neurologists have come to understand how real symptoms are and how people with them experience injustice and abuse, which is true for these poor kids. This shift has led to techniques that help people regain control over their bodies. What's more, it's shedding light on some past-long bodily experiences we have, all may have, and even the nature of consciousness itself. An awful lot of strange things we have noticed about the brain might fall into place if this is right, says Andy Clark, the cognitive scientist at the University of Edinburgh, UK. Well, I think there's that brain-gut thing, that there's neurons, your brain actually extends down your spinal column and into your gut. And so there's brain-gut, gut things, and that your gut is related to Alzheimer's disease, and it's all interconnected. I think it's quite interesting. The medical term for the condition which the body malfunctions without a visible structural cause is functional disorders. But they can go by many names. In the 19th century, they were called conversion disorders, based on the idea that the mental trauma is being converted into physical symptoms. Today, doctors may use the terms psychosomatic or medically unexplained symptoms. Now, on the opposite side, I was having big heart pains, and I was thinking, these are probably psychosomatic, so I've sort of went the opposite end. Today's doctors may use terms, this they mean a person who isn't lying about the symptoms, but neither can anything be found wrong with them, with that part of their body. Or simply they weren't doing the heart tests on me, so I thought, the doctor said, you're fine, you've just got a herbal imbalance, have these herbs, and I went away, it didn't fix. So I thought it was psychosomatic, but then they did tests. Rather, symptoms seem to be generated by something going wrong with their brain. It can be hard to believe, especially for those affected, but in a way, the group of people are thinking themselves ill. The mysterious illnesses aren't just seen on neurology wards. People may also have functional asthma, constipation, chest pains, and so on. But physical illness can almost easily be ruled out if the case of functional neurological symptoms, because of an array of highly accurate tests available for the nerves and muscles. So it must be an area in which the most research is done and the most progress. Okay, well, yeah. And you can, I think if you are thinking it, you can be distracted. It's just when you wake up with heart pain, you go, well, what the heck is going on? Or it's when you're going over a hill and stuff like that. As far as functional epilepsy, which is pain had, people can have problems with movements ranging from arms, leg weakness through tremors, tics, and even paralysis. Communication breakdown, page 31. Sensory problems may include pain, tingling, and blindness. Symptoms may resemble those of stroke or conditions like multiple sclerosis, but experienced neurologists can identify aspects that should be medically impossible, says Suzanne O'Sullivan of the National Hospital of Neurology and Neurosurgery, London. For instance, O'Sullivan's author of It's All in Your Head, True Stories from an Imagined Illness, once saw someone with a small, harmless growth of fatty tissue on the side of her head who was convinced it was a brain tumour. She experienced worsening weakness on that side of her body until she was almost paralysed, proving to her the cancer was growing into her brain. But she didn't know that one half of the brain controls the other side of the body, so she was wrong side that had become paralysed. There you go. Another person had a permanent muscle spasm on her hand. It was so strong that the fingers were curled inward and the hand left useless. Sullivan agreed to standard treatment, the injection of Botox, which paralyzed his muscles. Minutes later, the woman's fingers uncurled. She looked up in joy. But Botox takes days to work, so the woman had revealed that the problem lay not in her hand, but her head. Which is the entire thing. This happens so many times that if I think we are a social animal out into the wild, and showing illness is a sort of strange thing, sort of like animals themselves don't show that they're ill. It's interesting because animals particularly will behave normally because behaving as though they're in pain, and wincing pain is a signal to predators, this is something to eat, they won't survive, so there's that. But humans can communicate this. I find this interesting. Some doctors take instances like these as signs of persistence, a risk of those affected are well aware of. They are worried you think they're doing it on purpose, says O'Sullivan. They may also suspect of having Mount Johnson's, a much rarer psychiatric condition. Where people fake symptoms to seek medical care and attention. I think it's Munchausen by proxy is what House always used to find. It used to be Lyme's disease and Munchausen by proxy. I'd say a full 10% of House we do. And was it Hugh Laurie? What a disappointing actor at the end. There are no foolproof methods, but the time and experience doctors can generally distinguish between people faking and those genuinely baffled by what's happening to them, says John Stone, a neurologist at the University of Edinburgh. He notes that people with conditions submit to countless tests and return to doctors again and again because they desperately want to know what's wrong, which is true. And so a lot of the tests you do come in are ridiculously simple, and they're malingering tests. Cases such as this are surprisingly common. In a 2010 survey of people attending neurology clinics, 16% had some kind of functional disorder, making this the second most common reason for seeing a neurologist after headaches. Functional epilepsy also has, it's called dissociative attacks, can be one of the most alarming. If performed, an EEG shows that these episodes aren't seizures, where there's a surge in brain electrical activity, or have they same as faint caused by lack of blood to the head. Still, the person may collapse, start shaking, and be unable to remember what happened during the episode. An attack that lasts for more than a few minutes may result in the person being rushed to hospital. If the staff, by accident, and emergency department are unfamiliar with functional disorders, there are two risks. One, the doctors may treat this true seizure, administering potent drugs and putting the breathing tube down the throat, which can induce infections. Okay, The other is that the staff realise it is an episode and, lacking understanding, think the person is putting it on. Quote, there's an awful lot of unkindness towards people who develop this condition, says Payne. As people come around from dissociative attack, they regain awareness before they can speak or move, so have to lie there listening to sceptical remarks of staff. Payne herself has been told to snap out of it. Quote, if you don't stop doing it, if you could stop doing it, would you, she says. Worse, though, the doctors intensify their efforts to wake the person up, for instance, by inserting a needle or pressing with their knuckle at a tender spot in the chest, a procedure known as the sternal rub. Oh, my God, Father, sorry, having my stern cut open, that's there are normal techniques for gauging someone's level of consciousness. These are normal, but with dissociative attacks, they may be done repeatedly by doctors who suspect the person is faking. If this happens when the person has regained partial awareness, it can feel like they are being abused. So if people have functional disorders, neither pretending nor would have anything structurally wrong with the nervous system, what's the explanation? How do you think yourself feel? For much of the 20th century, doctors believed the condition stemmed exclusively from mental trauma. The mechanism was beyond understanding. See, why do functional symptoms start to the left? Things started to change with the arrival of brain scanning techniques called functional MRIs, fMRIs, that lets you to see the brain become active at different conditions. Several studies show that people with functional tremor, for instance, had different brain activity compared to volunteers asked to fake their tremor. That convinced doctors they weren't pretending or imagining things. They can see that they're not faking. That's as simple as that, isn't it? Yet progress in treatments have come a different route. Around 15 years ago, Stone became interested in something that had long been noted in medical textbooks but little explored. Functional symptoms tend to dwindle when people are distracted. Take functional tremor to their right hand. Ask them to hold out the hand and the tremor is especially pronounced. Ask them to hold out the left hand and tap it on the table and beat. With the tension focused away from the right hand, it may either stop shaking or pick up the same rhythm as the left. A tremor with a physical cause would remain the same. Similarly, another problem, such as weakness in the limb, lessens when the person is asked to do a task involving a different part of their body. These types of tests were routinely used for diagnosis, but doctors didn't discuss them with their patients. It is well known that some people recover simply by being told their functional diagnosis, if they accept it. So Stone started showing people how their symptoms abated under sedation, sometimes even filming them as they move their leg, for instance, to help convince them that the muscles were working normally. And then they began to go further by suggesting that if people use their own distraction techniques, if the symptoms began. This approach could even be used by people with dissociative attacks who often get warning signs before they lose awareness. It's proven so successful that patients... Oh, there you go. If only there was more scientists in the world. Groups now swap tips on the best techniques online. This can involve counting backwards in fives, looking around the room to spot things a certain colour, stroking a pet, or just talking to someone. Penny uses her walking stick, which has a series of holes in the metal shaft for height adjustment. Simply running your fingers over the holes provides enough distraction. You're making your brain think about something else, she says. And she's been off medication, free for seizures, for 2 years. Okay. Some small trials of this technique have shown positive results from both... Well, are you thinking yourself, Will? Are you... Yeah, I don't know. There's yet another thing. Are you... Is it a genuine thing, or is it a fake... Is it a fake cure for a fake thing, I would ask. Some small trials of techniques have shown positive results for dissociative attacks and movement problems, and larger studies are underway. Although it's encouraging, distraction doesn't tend to work instantly, especially if people have been immobile for a long time and the muscles have weakened through lack of use. Some hospitals now offer tailored physiotherapy programs based around distraction, where people gradually relearn their lost abilities. This is interesting because, say, with getting my knee back, they want me to do parallel physiotherapies and cognitive things at the same time, or mixed together many different pathways. Quote, by showing them how to redirect attention, we trigger normal movement patterns underneath, she says, Mark Edwards, a neurologist at St. George University, London, who stumbled upon distraction treatment around the same time as Stone. Intriguing, the approach shed light on the underlying cause of functional symptoms, says Edward. According to one theory about how the brain works, it normally works, we experience the world not as raw data arriving in our senses, but instead as a meld of this data with our predictions and expectations. Edgar argues that in functional disorders, circuitry goes wrong so that the brain places too much weight on these predictions instead of the inputs from the senses. If someone who has functional blindness, for instance, the expectation of darkness over us is signals for the optic nerves. Someone cannot move an arm, believes that the limb will override the real nerve signals from the muscles. These predictions are wrong. Every time you try to assess the movement, it goes wrong. Edwards. It's unclear why the predictions go wrong, though. One idea is that due to people paying excessive attention to malfunctioning parts of the body, whether consciously or subconsciously. Several studies have shown that people with functional disorders redirect more attention to all of their bodily sensations than people without these disorders. Distraction techniques could be helped simply diverting attention. But whether or not Edward's explanation turns out to be right, distraction techniques are already helping people recover from functional conditions. They're no panacea. They're less likely to work if people also have a hard-to-treat conditions such as depression or arthritis. And some people have several functional symptoms mixed together and waxing away and over time, making it hard to achieve progress. And I would say that a lot of this folk medicine and folk beliefs and functional stuff, some people don't accept the diagnosis. This is understandable, said Alice Somerville. Imagine you have been in a wheelchair for 5 years and thought you had multiple sclerosis. I'm telling you, you're functional. You're still disabled, but you're potentially going to lose all the support you've had, perhaps financial benefits. And now you have to tell your neighbours and your employers. A lot depends on the doctor's experience and tact and whether they are specialists, physiotherapists, psychological services for rehabilitations. But sometimes it seems to be changing. And we're getting better at helping functional disorders, then there may be wider benefits too, said Edwards. And so this is where an MRI brain scan really helps, to clear the air. Some people with clear physical illnesses with the degree of symptoms may bear little relations to the disease severity shown in objective tests. That may be because physical illnesses is being worsened by what is sometimes called a functional overlay. Any symptoms are a combination of physiological process in your brain and sensing is presenting it to you, says Edwards. The idea may help explain the placebo effect. Okay. So there's a pre, in your low, there's a pre-load of people with it. So what you really think to do is that if you've got a group of people who are placebo effect sensitive, you then remove them from your study. So you, that would be really interesting. That is very interesting to go through. The influence is usually rather small, accounting for instance, a fall of 1 or 2 points on the 10-point pain scale. That might be a disease functional overlay melting away under the power of expectation. Even those who aren't ill can experience something similar in mind over matter. It's just as negative expectation about part of the body can make that part malfunctioning. Positive expectation is shown to boost performance, increasing endurance in sport, for instance. The takeaway message is that we can conceive our world is what constructs our consciousness experience, says Clark. Some of the predictions bring about the very thing you have predicted. You could harness that if we're all ill. If these ideas are right, any signs we gain from learning how to help people with functional disorders could end up benefiting us. One day, a fairly vulnerable group of patients may be recognised for having contributed to improving human health, said Edwards. That's my fantasy. Isn't that beautiful? It's a fantasy illness, and he's got a fantasy that this fantasy illness will help us. The choice engine. The idea that we lack free will is built upon a mistaken sense of what it means to be biological machine, argues psychologist Tom Stafford. So this is going to be very interesting. So I haven't seen this before. A simple insect can help us understand free will, the lack of it. When a female digger wasp is ready to lay her eggs, she hunts down a cricket or similar prey, paralyzes it, stings it, drags it back to the lip of a barrow, then enters to check for blockages. If you move the cricket a few centimetres away before she re-emerges, she will again drag it to the threshold again and leave it to check for blockages. She will do this over and over. The wasp has no choice. This mindlessly inflexible behaviour has led to the wasp Sphex immoculus becoming a byword amongst psychobiologists for determinism. So this is a classic experiment, isn't it? That you can repeat and they'll never ever learn. But I think they do this. The other classic experiment is hitting sea cucumbers or sea squirts to train them up. It is tempting to think that we aren't like wasps, that we do as a result of choices that are freely made. Yet the more we learn about neuroscience, decision making is more sphexic than we seem to be. You hear people arguing that humans aren't mere biological machines trapped in cycles of behavior that ultimately are beyond our control, free will, and it's just an illusion. Well, I just think I think there's a lack of free will, but you've got to see that people exist in a biological engine. You know, there's an interrelationship where they discount facts and scientific facts and increase their social connection, you know, their social connectivity with things. How much they attribute the importance to other things means that they're plugging themselves into a social consciousness, is my view. As cognitive science also, as a cognitive scientist who studies decision making, I disagree. Of course, humans are animals. The problem, I believe, our misguided intuitions of what it means to be a biological machine. In an attempt to dispel some of the misconceptions, I've created an interactive essay on Twitter called The Choice Engine. That's interesting. My view is that it's infinitely more complex in terms of a social machine. You've got... it's a complex machine. So it's a multi-state complex machine. So, How aspects may be linked with free will is a long story. Charles Darwin was studying this while working in the theory of evolution. We know from his notebooks that its behaviour had a big impact on him. He wasn't aware that it would be ceaselessly cheat its burrow. That discovery was made decades later by Nicholas Tilbury, a founder of ethology, a science of animal behaviour. What interested Darwin was that the wasp does, once it has dragged the creature into its burrow, it lays eggs on the body and immobilises the still living prey. When the larvae hatch, they eat it from the inside out. Darwin was so appalled by this behaviour that he cited it as one reason for his loss of faith. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent, omnipotent God would have designed and created the with the express intention of her feeding within living bodies, he wrote. Meanwhile, his theory wasn't just undermined God. Some took it as support for the idea that humans were mere animals and animals are mere machines, fanning the flames of a millennia-old debate about free will. To Darwin, Sphex was emblematic of the cruelty found in nature. Tilbury exposed it as emblematic of nature's marvelous. So the same wasp was seen as, one looked at the behaviour of it. The other wasp is, I can't work it out. So you move the thing away, and its loop is move it to the burrow, then check the burrow. Then you move it back, and so you've cancelled one function, then we'll check the burrow again for blockages, but it's already done. Okay. But it was the philosopher Daniel Dennett and Tufts University in Massachusetts who coined the word sphexishness to describe the nature of human choice if we say it's like those of other animals. In doing so, he highlighted the common misconception that we must either reject an idea that biology influences our choices or reject the notion of free will. This is a fallacy. I myself think there's a social dimension. It depends how your people's choice. They lose free will if they plug themselves mindlessly into a social engine. This fallacy is the nub of the problem. Biology certainly influences our choices, as plenty of evidence show. Perhaps the most famous example is the experiment on free will done in the 1980s by Benjamin Libet. He showed that brain activity associated with an action occurs before the subjective feeling of choosing action, which is pretty amazing. That is, you make a decision, but the brain activity to make that decision, you make your free will after you've made your decision. It's beautiful. More recently, Libet's experiments were replicated in addition of fMRI scan. This time, the researchers were able to predict some actions from the brain activities up to 10 seconds before the conscious decision was taken. The brain activity precedes the feeling of choice, some have argued. All choosing is just an illusion. Well, that's if you consider someone in a brain, but if you consider the brain as a social brain, you know, it's a bigger thing. So, yeah, that's my view. Results the great challenge to the free will that they might seem to be at first. Their apparent force relies on misguided intuitions about what it means to have free will. We tend to think in terms of ourself versus other causes. We assume that the more of these other causes that are involved in the decision-making process, the less self-determination or free will is involved. Misconception arises because we have difficulty comprehending causation and complex systems. And this is what I say is that obviously, to take the ultimate thing is the German race being taken over by the Nazis, which is a sort of like a social mind virus. So you've got the individuals, and the mind virus takes control, the ability to make decisions. I'm not justifying it, but I'm just aware of it. We tend to think of our terms of self versus other causes, and we assume that the more of these other causes are involved in the decision-making process, the less self-determination or free will is involved. This misconception arises because we have difficulty comprehending causation in a complex system. We tend to think about the cause and effect in a one-to-one relationship, A causes B. In reality, it's always a set of things happening or not happening that causes the other set of things to happen or not happen. Discovering what A was involved in causing B doesn't mean the other factors aren't important, which I 100% agree. You've got this, basically we are a neural network in a social neural network, and you've got to, it's a huge thing, especially this folk knowledge is such an intense way. Causality encompasses everything from your genes to the ideas about the future. As we found new facts about genes and brains, the space in which yourself exists, your free will, responsibility and choices doesn't diminish. This is something I've been pondering for years. What's really brought it home to me was interacting with a complex chaotic system called cellular automation. Well, this is exactly what I was talking about. We are cellular. It means we're talking about like a cell phone. So cellular automation is that automation is within an area. So this is exactly my thoughts. It's amazing. And seeing the simplest rules can generate an endless, unpredictable set of behaviours. I mean, there's chaos theory and all that type of stuff. And these are unstable systems, aren't they? They can predict so many different things. This is a grid world created on a computer with basic rules for changing each tile grid from black to white and vice versa. With the right rules, the right starting conditions, it can generate an infinite number of unpredictable patterns. Seeing from so simple a beginning, endless forms being born, this makes us realise that fear we are speculative on the basis. There's no need to worry that something as complex as a human can be caught in a meaningless leap. Well, I would say that folk beliefs, which are wrong in the face of evidence, huge amounts of evidence, is being caught in the loop, except we as a system operate on multiple paths at the same time, and so we evolve as a stability, there's a dominance of the folk thought, and it's just, the difference now is that we've got the awareness of the game theory and stuff like that going through. It was to explore these ideas more that I created the Choice Engine. You can find this interactive at Choice Engine Start. And the bot will guide you through, letting you choose your own unique path through the story, following areas that most interest you. In it, I argue, our intuitions mean the problem of free will will never feel solved, but it is. The solution is that we are part of nature. We are complex machines. If you change the intuitions about such machines can do and what those interactions can mean, then you realize you are free to make real, meaningful choices. Yes, our thoughts are caused by our brains, our environment, and our history, but the causal mix is unique to each individual and each moment. This explains why human behavior is so difficult to predict. Okay. My career researching the brain and how we choose this has made me optimistic that we do have free will. Darwin's theory of evolution gives us a fear of being mere creatures. I simply disagree. The word mere. We are creatures, but we're not mere creatures. There is enough tangled complexity in relation to the brain and mind that we can retain meaningful view of free will, at the same time recognize the nature of living machines. Well, I think it's a little, for me, that's really interesting because, this is the folk knowledge and seeing how the information itself is what's being preserved in the culture. A culture propagates both the genes and culture. Okay, the big question. Let's see how we're going here. I might stop this and break this up for a second go. So, item four. So, this is for episode four going through and see if I can break it. Because I've been going for 15 minutes and I noticed that if I sort of go forward in chunks rather than burn myself out early, I can go much further. But I'm hopefully improving. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.